6 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in Northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next on the media and 7 o'clock weekend edition from National Public Radio, we'll also hear the Up North Report, local news from our region. Mostly cloudy through mid-morning, then clearing today with highs 38 to 44, winds from the northwest 10 to 20. Our lows tonight 32 to 36, and for tomorrow mostly sunny, highs 51 to 58. Looking ahead to Monday, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 30s to low 40s and breezy northwest wind. Thanks for listening to KAXE this morning. It is time now for On the Media.
The U.S. military is using AI tools to identify targets in its strikes on Iran, even as the government feuds with the maker of that same technology.
President Trump, in his Truth Social post, criticized Anthropic for being far left and for being woke. They're trying to impose essentially a sanctions regime.
When disagreeing with the government can put you out of business. From WNYC in New York, I'm Brooke Gladstone. Want to see modern AI-powered weaponry at work? Check out Ukraine, where both sides are using these.
A hovering drone that stays far enough up in the atmosphere that it's almost impossible to even sense from the ground, and it's poised to strike.
Plus, nations that have recently struggled to preserve their democracies offer some possible scenarios for the U.S.
Ping-ponging between authoritarianism and democracy, which is frightening to think about, but it could very well be the future.
All coming up after this.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. Around 40 people rode a charter bus down to St. Paul Thursday for the 19th annual Bemidji Day at the state capitol. Officials from the City of Bemidji, Bemidji Area Schools, and Beltrami County were joined by Bemidji Area Chamber of Commerce members and others in signature red buffalo plaid for a day of lobbying on issues that impact northern Minnesota communities. Bemidji City Council Member at Large Audrey Thayer led a group of Leech Lake Tribal College students, all of whom had never been to the state capitol before, to meet with lawmakers. Student Candace Jones, who declined a plaid vest in favor of her ribbon skirt, advocated for housing issues, education resources, and protections for wild rice.
Wildlife around the surrounding areas, the water plays a big part in wild rice as well.
After meeting with Republican State Senator Eric Lucero, Jones says she gained some new insight on some of the bureaucracy behind why many landlords like Lucero don't accept Section 8 vouchers. Lucero told her the vouchers intended to provide rental assistance for low-income families come with too many federal mandates. Chamber member Christy Turn, representing Paul Bunyan Communications, had also never participated in a Bemidji Day at the state capitol before.
It's just so important for us to share our story of the county and the impacts and, you know, the sheer size of our county, the poverty of our county, and how we rank in the state and how these government mandates impact that.
Chamber Director Scott Turn says his staff set up 45 different appointments with lawmakers, splitting up the Bemidji Day group into several teams to cover more ground.
It's important for us to come down there. We're not the Bemidji of 20, 30 years ago. We have a lot of great things happening, but we have a lot of challenges too.
Several other groups were lobbying at the Capitol Thursday, including the Minnesota Historical Society and the state's transportation engineers. And perhaps most adorably, the Animal Humane Society brought in puppies for the annual Puppy Day at the Capitol. Beltrami County residents and stakeholders are invited to submit input as the Office of Emergency Management works to update its hazard mitigation plan. The multi-jurisdictional plan covers Beltrami County and all cities, townships, school districts, watershed districts, and other related agencies and organizations to assess natural hazards that pose risk to the county. The plan looks at floods, tornadoes, windstorms, winter storms, wildfire, and drought, and identifies community vulnerabilities and ways to minimize damage from future events. Emergency Management Director Chris Muller says hazard mitigation planning, quote, helps break the cycle of damage and repair caused by things like flooding, ice storms, and severe wind events that can damage property, stress economies, and threaten life safety in our county. More information is at KAXE.org. Townships across Minnesota will host their annual meetings on Tuesday. During the meetings, township residents can have a direct voice on their township's annual tax levy. And in addition to voting on the levy for the next year, they can review spending and action plans. Many of the state's 1,776 townships also conduct township officer elections on the second Tuesday of March. Information on township elections is advertised in their respective legal newspapers and can often be found online. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is seeking public comment on two sets of proposed changes at Itasca State Park. One of the proposed management plan amendments would upgrade Itasca's cross-country ski trails, add new overnight camping and lodging options, and remove the Nicollet Court Guesthouse by Douglas Lodge. Another amendment would redevelop the public water accesses at Bear Paw Campground and Douglas Lodge into carry-in-use only. The DNR will host an open house on the proposed changes from 5 to 7 p.m. on Tuesday, March 24th at the Jacob V. Brower Visitor Center at the Itasca State Park. Comments may be submitted through April 10th. The Superior National Forest invites the public to an open house about the Tofte Ranger District. The open house is scheduled for 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, March 12th at the Isabella Community Center. Forest staff will share information about upcoming road and trail construction, prescribed fire activities, and recreation projects. Participants can also learn more about Forest Service careers and volunteer or partnership opportunities. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Michael Loewinger's out this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. If, like much of America, you're puzzled by the who, what, where, forget about the why, of our nation's war with Iran, never fear. The administration's brain trust has you covered.
The White House is using video game footage to promote its war strategy.
This is a video that was posted on X and other platforms that mixes Call of Duty video game footage with actual clips of actual American missile strikes from inside Iran.
Of course, that doesn't cover everything, like the fact that the U.S. and Israel have launched well over 1,000 strikes so far from drones and missiles, killing over 1,000 people, including more than 160 at an Iranian girls' school, mostly children.
New video released by Iranian state media shows the grim work in Manab has already begun, digging tiny graves for some of the littlest victims of this three-day-old war.
Also noteworthy, the Pentagon has used an advanced AI system called Claude in its attacks, even as it has condemned its maker, Anthropic, as a security risk. Puzzling indeed.
For more than a decade, the U.S. military has been integrating AI tools into a whole lot of what it does.
Siva Vaidyanathan is a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia, currently working on a book about AI and democracy.
In its later years in Afghanistan, it was using tools from Palantir and other firms to help vet intelligence, the stuff that people had posted on social media, YouTube videos, anything to help identify a potential target or a potential threat or get a real sense of the political conditions on the ground. And that practice now has reached a higher level.
Right. You mentioned Palantir, which has been providing intelligence analysis, military targeting to the U.S. government or allies, including Israel. And it has AI technologies embedded in Israeli and U.S. weapon systems. But I'm still not clear about Palantir's role. What does it do?
Well, Palantir supplies what you might think of as the operating system of a whole lot of military intelligence projects. They've done this largely through the Army, also through the Marines, and now increasingly through all the areas of armed forces, through a set of independent contracts. There was a lot of resistance during the early years of the Biden administration to having Palantir deploy an intelligence system that would replace one that soldiers had been using all the way back to the Iraq War. And Palantir managed through its lobbying efforts and publicity efforts to convince enough people in Congress and then ultimately in the Pentagon to become the dominant supplier of a platform that soldiers in the field and officers in headquarters around the world use to pick out targets and analyze potential intelligence and help them make judgments, if not make judgments itself.
Yeah. And the owner of Palantir is a great, good supporter of Trump, gives him tons of money.
Well, Palantir is a publicly traded company, so we actually probably own a piece of Palantir. You know, like if you have a retirement fund, the chairman of the board is Peter Thiel, who is, of course, notorious for being the first leading Silicon Valley billionaire to openly support Donald Trump in 2016. When I look at Silicon Valley now, I see, you know, all of this stuff that is shaking the very premise of NATO, of the international order that has allowed the United States to be so dominant in military and economic matters, is now in doubt. And I can't help but think it's largely under the influence of this handful of billionaires who want to see a multipolar world where the United States is operating as a rogue nation.
Mm. So we'll be covering the really interesting contract battle between Anthropic and the Defense Department later in the show. But meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal reported that our military used Anthropic's Claude AI tool in its attacks on Iran mere hours after Trump ordered government agencies on Friday to stop working with Anthropic because it posed a threat. This is interesting timing, no?
It looked to me, and it looked to a lot of people who follow the AI industry, that the Pentagon and Trump were taking advantage of the moment and taking advantage of the fact that Anthropic has these principles built into their contracts. Two major principles. One, Anthropic does not want its technology used for mass surveillance of U.S. citizens, and Anthropic does not want its technology used to develop autonomous weapons, weapons that will decide to deploy themselves, decide to kill people in the absence of human judgment.
The head of Anthropic said that their AI is not yet capable of making good decisions in this regard.
You know, every one of my students who's ever come up with a fake citation in a paper knows this as well as anybody. You do not trust even the most high-level large language models to guide crucial decisions.
Claude isn't just a large language model.
Claude is basically a large language model. It also does things, like many large language models, at the enterprise level that are really complicated. This particular version of Claude happens to do so with enough quality control for security and privacy that can work with the government in this way, which is why this sudden decision to abandon Claude, to shun Anthropic as a company, was so shocking, especially that it occurred just 48 hours before an attack on a major country and the beginning of a major war. I mean, it's just wacky.
We'll hear more from Siva later in the show, but first, let's dig into just how wacky the Pentagon's pronouncements about Anthropic are. Alan Rosenstein, research director and senior editor at Lawfare, notes that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, demanding unrestricted use for all, quote, lawful purposes, is using a rarely applied statute to crush Anthropic altogether by declaring it a, quote, supply chain risk.
This allows the Secretary of Defense, largely on his own authority, to designate a company a supply chain risk based on concerns that that company would engage in subterfuge or sabotage. The statute is written reasonably broadly. It talks about sort of any company, any entity, any person. But when you look into why Congress enacted it, when you look into the debates that were happening in Congress at the time, it's clear that Congress was concerned about the fact that a lot of high-end technological services and goods were being made by countries like China, like Russia. And that would be very concerning to have those in the defense supply chain. That's why Congress gave the Secretary of Defense the power to identify individual companies, block them from being part of defense contracts and also block defense contractors from using those companies as part of defense contracts, because you don't necessarily want Chinese technology as your prime contractor, but you don't also want to discover that it's being used as a subcontractor or some subcontractor for one of your projects. The marquee examples here are the Chinese companies Huawei and ZTE. These are makers of high-end telecommunications equipment, and there's long been concern that
they're putting bugs in their equipment.
Essentially. And then for Russia, Russia doesn't produce so much hardware, but there is a famous cybersecurity company called Kaspersky, which produces a lot of software, and similar concerns that that cybersecurity software might have bugs, backdoors, all sorts of things like that.
Now, Hegseth is trying to impose this supply chain risk thing to Anthropic in an unusually punitive way, right? Or is this how it's always been?
We don't actually know how it's always been, because these are relatively new statutes and they've only been publicly used once, but there's certainly no evidence that they've ever been used against a domestic company.
This sounds to me a little bit like what Trump was trying to do to what he deemed overly woke big law firms and universities, isolate them from income.
I think that's actually exactly the right comparison to draw. President Trump, in fact, in his Truth Social post, criticized Anthropic literally for being far left and for being woke. This president, this administration, is singling out entities that do not do business on the terms that the administration would prefer. And instead of simply saying, okay, well, we're not going to do business with you, they're trying to impose essentially a sanctions regime.
Explain how that works.
Well, sure. The law permits the Secretary of Defense to, again, not just ban a supply chain risk from doing direct business with the government, but from indirectly doing business with the government through another defense contractor. But what Hegseth is purporting to do, and this is beyond the scope of the statute and almost certainly illegal, he's purporting to ban anyone who does business with the Defense Department from having any commercial relationship with Anthropic. Now, that's breathtakingly wide. Not only would that potentially cut off a lot of Anthropic's enterprise customers, many of whom also happen to be defense contractors, even if they're not using Claude for any defense projects, but it would also potentially ban companies like Amazon and Google, which are massive defense contractors, not to mention NVIDIA, the chipmaker, another defense contractor, from, for example, selling cloud compute to Anthropic or selling computer chips to Anthropic, which would effectively destroy the company.
So despite the fact that Claude may be the most advanced of these large language model AIs, the government really could put Anthropic out of business.
Well, I think what the government is doing is pretty clearly illegal. But of course, there's always a chance that courts rule the other way. And also, even if it wins the legal case, if the government can scare away some of its clients because those clients understand that the government doesn't like Anthropic and therefore might not like companies that themselves do business with Anthropic, that itself could be a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
Let me back up just for a second and try to separate two issues that are often being conflated by all sides in this current situation. The first question is, what should the relationship be between the military and the private sector? Or to put it another way, if we're going to have a military-industrial complex, should the military run that or should the industrial side of that hyphen run that?
And that's where the government has a point in its favor.
Absolutely. In a democracy where you have civilian control over the military, you do fundamentally want the military to be able to use services and goods according to its judgment as run by the civilian leadership and according to the laws. Now, I think there are reasons to be very skeptical that this administration in particular even can be trusted to abide by the laws. But if we just abstract for a moment, there's a very strong argument that the military should push back against attempts by AI companies to restrict the use of those services. But the second question is, if the military cannot get an AI company to agree to do business on the terms the military wants, what should the military do? Should it say, okay, no thank you, we're going to take our business elsewhere, shake hands and leave? Or should the military try to burn the company to the ground? This second question does not seem to me to be a difficult one. And I would have thought we could get bipartisan support for not burning the company to the ground. But here we are.
Yeah.
I still think, though, it is useful because however this resolves itself, the broader policy question is not going to go away. In an ideal world, what should the relationship between the military and private industry be? And there, I think this is a tricky question. You know, we could have an adult conversation. Unfortunately, the people running the Pentagon are not the adults we need to have that conversation.
Just to clarify, there hasn't been any formal announcement of the Pentagon's decision, nor has it issued official certifications and notifications to Congress. All we have is this X post from Hegseth and Trump's Truth Social post announcing, and I quote, "And when my voice goes up, that's when it's all caps. I am directing every federal agency in the United States government to immediately cease all use of Anthropic's technology. We don't need it, we don't want it, and will not do business with them again. There will be a 6-month phase-out period for agencies like the Department of War who are using Anthropic's products at various levels." I'm assuming that's why Anthropic hasn't taken any legal action.
That is my understanding as well. Though first I should say, Brooke, I think you may have missed your calling as a voice actress. My understanding is that, in fact, Anthropic has not received a formal designation given this administration. I don't think it's so surprising that they're not doing a great job dotting the I's and crossing the T's. But presumably, at some point, they will get around to doing a designation. Though I should also say, it's possible that the same taco principle that applies to the president might apply here to the Secretary of Defense. And that either because they're currently slightly occupied with a war in Iran, or because they just realize that what they're doing is both silly and legally unsupportable, this all goes away. But I think for the moment, we have to take them at their word and assume that a designation is coming, at which point Anthropic will sue, as they've said that they will.
What legal arguments could Anthropic use against it?
This is, as they say in the military, a target-rich environment for Anthropic. This is about as legally unsupportable as I think it gets. And that's a big deal, because if there's any place where the government gets maximal deference, where judges do not want to be in the business of second-guessing executive branch determinations, it's when it comes to national security. That's saying quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So there are basically three reasons why this designation is so flawed. The first reason is that it's not at all obvious that the law at issue even applies to an entity like Anthropic, a U.S. company that is transparently describing the limitations that it wants. The second reason is, whatever the ability of the government to exclude a company from government contracts, that in no way extends to the extremely broad secondary boycott of all commercial relations. And then the third reason is that, just on its face, the government's declaration that Anthropic is a supply chain risk is absurd, for a simple reason. Before the designation, Secretary Hegseth was threatening to invoke the Defense Production Act, which would require Anthropic to sell Claude to the government. And still, there's reporting that people within the administration are considering invoking the Defense Production Act.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, hours after the designation was made, we went to war with Iran, and Anthropic services were used in that operation, and as far as I know, are continuing to be used. And so the government is simultaneously arguing that the services are so vital that Anthropic might be compelled to provide them to the government. They're so safe that they can be used in ongoing military operations. And they're so dangerous that Anthropic must not only be excluded from government contracts, but basically razed to the ground. The math doesn't math, as they say.
Coming up, more from Alan Rosenstein on the wild, wild world of military supply chains. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering both virtual and hybrid positions with opportunities for career growth, pay increases, and healthcare benefits. More information and applications are available at careers.progressive.com. And by Seed.com. Seed's DS01 is a 24-strain, 2-in-1 probiotic and prebiotic engineered to survive digestion, support healthy regularity, and promote whole body health. Learn more at SEED.com/public.
You're listening to On the Media on People Powered KAXE. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, weekend edition news from National Public Radio. Plus, we'll hear the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can find more stories from our news team at KAXE.org, plus morning show conversations and music features. At 9 o'clock this morning, we have a special for you. Malachi Coons has a conversation and music with Indigenous archivist Justice Broken Rope. Justice runs Watecha Records, dedicated to finding and sharing little-known Native artists from the past. You'll hear some of the music he's collected and the importance of having art that represents your community. 10 o'clock this morning, Corey Campbell, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Cloudy this morning, then clearing with highs 38 to 44, northwest winds 10 to 20. Our lows tonight 32 to 36, and tomorrow mostly sunny, and highs 51 to 58.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone, picking up on my interview with Lawfare's Alan Rosenstein. So, right after Anthropic was thrown to the curb, its main rival, OpenAI, was waiting in the wings to pick up the defense contract for itself. OpenAI says there's language in their contract that includes even stricter provisions than Anthropic. But...
Well, so the question of what OpenAI agreed to is very unclear. You are correct. OpenAI, just as Anthropic was being designated a supply chain risk, announced that it had reached an agreement to use its systems on Pentagon classified networks. But OpenAI CEO Sam Altman has insisted that OpenAI had succeeded in implementing its own red lines, which were very similar to Anthropic's, and in fact had gone even beyond what Anthropic wanted. OpenAI then released a few paragraphs from the contract publicly. And the problem for OpenAI is that the contract terms that they released did not support their claim about red lines. Then in recent days, OpenAI has said, well, actually, some of the critics had a point. We've gone back to the Department of Defense. We've gotten them to agree to stronger protections for surveillance specifically. I would say that there are three possibilities here, three doors, if you will, mm-hmm. and it's to me completely unclear which door the car is behind. Door number one is that OpenAI has succeeded where Anthropic failed. It has succeeded in getting the government to agree to meaningful red lines that limit the government's use beyond, quote, all lawful uses. But that would raise the question, of course, and it would give Anthropic strong litigating ammunition. Well, if the government is okay with OpenAI's red lines, why aren't they okay with Anthropic's red lines? That's door number one. Door number two is that OpenAI did not, in fact, negotiate meaningful red lines, but it has presented itself as having done so, presumably for PR purposes. Mm-hmm. That would be very bad. OpenAI is an institution, has a lot of skepticism around it for not always being candid. And if it is door number two, that would add to that skepticism. Mm-hmm. Door number three, and if I had to pick a door, I would suspect it's door number three, mm-hmm. that OpenAI thinks that it got real concessions from the Pentagon, but the Pentagon disagrees. And that there is not, and this is what we in the law call, a meeting of the minds between contract parties. This happens all the time with complicated contracts. You think you have an agreement, but each side reads the contract slightly differently. And that's a big problem for OpenAI because the government tends to already have some structural advantages when it comes to contracts with private entities. So that's a big problem. If OpenAI finds out down the line that the government is not upholding what it thinks is the government side of mm-hmm. the bargain.
Now, one of the reasons for one of the red lines that Anthropic imposed is that Anthropic chief Dario Amodei doesn't think Claude is ready to handle autonomous weapons operation, that it's just not there.
That is correct. Anthropic's position is often, I think, mischaracterized as being against autonomous weapons. I actually don't think that's Anthropic's position. I think they think that there may be an appropriate role for autonomous weapons in military actions, that those weapons actually can be more protective of civilians, for example, than human beings. I tend to agree that that is a possibility and should be seriously considered, that we should not simply rule out the possibility of autonomous weapons. But my understanding is that Anthropic's main concern is that its systems are not currently ready for autonomous weapons. I'm not even sure the government disagrees with that. I think the dispute, and here I think both sides have reasonable arguments, who should mm-hmm. decide when the autonomous weapon that uses Claude as its brain is ready for prime time?
I would assume that would be the person who knows Claude's brain best.
I'm not sure about that, actually. Anthropic probably understands the abstract capabilities of its model the best, but the military quite possibly understands how that integrates into military strategy and doctrine best. And also, it's the military, not Anthropic, that ultimately has the final say of what counts as a sufficiently accurate system. Mm-hmm. So, under both military guidelines and under the international laws of war, a system does not have to be foolproof to be lawful. It has to be sufficiently foolproof relative to military objectives. Obviously, this question is a combination of technical considerations, where I think Anthropic would have a lot of expertise, but also military and military law questions. And so the substantive dispute is who should have the veto? And I think that's a fair question to ask.
I just fear a lack of expertise. I see what you're saying. Ultimately, and as a legal matter, we don't want corporations running our foreign policy or our wars. I get that. Right now, it seems like OpenAI has won that $200 million Pentagon contract, and Anthropic might be struggling with their designation as a supply chain risk, at least in the next few months. You're proposing that in the long run, this conflict could actually strengthen the brand.
Oh, very much so. Anthropic might lose some money from this contract, but even more valuable for all these companies than computational resources is human talent. AI is a field where literally tens of billions of dollars of value can be locked in the head of a singularly talented engineer. And a lot of these engineers, they've already worked for these companies. They're already multimillionaires. They don't need more money. What they want is to work for companies that are at the frontier of research and also companies where they can feel good about working for them. And I think what Anthropic has done by really standing up for principles, you can agree with the principles, disagree with the principles, but you can't question that they have stood up for their principles, is that they have uniquely marked themselves out as the only company in Silicon Valley that has really put its money where its mouth is. It's not to say that other companies wouldn't necessarily do that, but we don't know.
Well, they've had chances in the past and they haven't.
That's also true. So I would expect that this will hugely, hugely, hugely benefit Anthropic, both in terms of its ability to recruit the top talent, but also more generally in its brand among normal people. I mean, one thing I'll notice is that, you know, the musician Katy Perry had a post on X saying how she was signing up for Claude, which is to say, I think this has broken through to normies, as they say. Reputationally, this is a huge windfall for Anthropic, and I think it's a well-deserved one.
So, in your Lawfare podcast, you said you saw this moment as the opening shot in what will be the most important conversation about AI regulation, how much the industry will or should be nationalized in the future.
Let me back up just for a second and say what I mean when I say the word nationalized. Mm-hmm. When I'm talking about whether AI will be nationalized, I'm not limiting myself to Cuba-style nationalization.
Taking over an oil well.
Exactly. It comes in and expropriates private property. That's conceivable, but I don't think that's what's going to happen in the United States, and there are various constitutional barriers. What I mean is that the most important questions in AI, who will develop the most advanced models? Who will get access to the most advanced models? Will the public get access, or will the best stuff be reserved for the government? Those kinds of questions. In a world where the government is making those decisions, I consider that a kind of nationalization. Mm-hmm. And of course, we've had this before. The whole history of the military-industrial complex from World War II through the modern day is of figuring out the parameters of control between the government and the military. And there's a wide range of plausible answers that analysts can advocate for in good faith. We obviously have been talking about AI now for several years. We have been debating various forms of regulation, whether it's, you know, state-level bans on this or that, whether it's questions about copyright. All of those are obviously very important. But the more fundamental question of just how much authority will the government exercise over the core building and operating of these models, that to me is the most important question. And I think this dispute between Anthropic and the Pentagon, and also this side question of what is the agreement between OpenAI and the Pentagon, this is the first time that we as a society have truly grappled with this fundamental question. Now, because of how, frankly, silly this Pentagon is behaving, we're having this debate in the dumbest way possible. But the fact that the current debate is being done on such foolish grounds does not change the fact that this is a debate that desperately needs to happen and where the outcome is far from clear.
Even if Anthropic does okay, the decision in this case simply opens that debate up. It doesn't close it down.
And this may be a silver lining of the situation, that despite the shambolic nature of what the administration is doing, it's at least forcing a debate. The Democrats are getting involved in this now. This is becoming something that not just nerds like me who are obsessed with AI talk about. I think people are realizing that there are real rule of law implications to this. Again, this is not how I would want to have the debate, but it's better to have the debate than not have the debate.
Alan, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Alan Rosenstein is an associate professor of law at the University of Minnesota Law School and a research director and senior editor at Lawfare. Now back to Siva Vaidyanathan with background on the evolving use of AI-powered weapons in Ukraine and Gaza, starting with Ukraine.
Ukraine instantly turned itself into a laboratory of technological innovation. The Ukrainian military, which has done a remarkable job against a much better funded and staffed military, has done so by outsourcing so many important things to private companies. This experimentation has resulted in one of the most, I think, important military weapons developed in the last couple of decades, and that is a hovering drone, a drone that stays far enough up in the atmosphere that it's almost impossible to even sense from the ground, and it's poised to strike. And that means Russian troops in the field are under constant possible attack. Now, of course, the Russian military developed the same technology. And so troops in Ukraine and civilians in Ukraine are also under the same constant threat. So we can move forward to Gaza and see how Israel, which has had its own programs of mass surveillance using artificial intelligence for more than a decade to try to identify hostile parties both in the West Bank and in Gaza, and frankly in Lebanon as well. So given that for the last 3 years, Israel has been trying to pick out whom to attack in a densely populated urban scene like Gaza is really hard. And so what they've done is they've outsourced it to machines that they hope are quite precise. Now, what we do know is given the large number of civilian casualties, the medical facilities, the human rights organizations that have been interrupted, bombed, etc., the number of journalists killed, that either Israel is being duplicitous about their desires for targeting, or the systems just aren't as good as they hope.
You write that what was normalized in Gaza will not stay in Gaza. You say this isn't just about an export of technology. It's an export of a habit of mind.
That basically says we can do everything faster. We can do everything easier. We can take human beings out of the loop as much as possible.
And we're living in an age where accountability seems an impossible dream. You call autonomous weapons, quote, accountability dissolving machines.
That's right. If stuff is happening so fast and so furiously, it's a lot harder for inspectors general, for judge advocate generals, attorneys general. It's a lot harder for courts to make individual discrete judgments in a timely fashion to actually affect anything in the world. And so the more we raise the metabolism of warfare, the harder it is to oversee the proper execution of warfare, the moral execution of warfare, if there is such a thing, the humanity that might be embedded in warfare. And look, we've been struggling, definitely since World War I, with increased attention after Vietnam War, with all of its excesses of civilian casualties and human rights violations, to embed within the U.S. military a sense of honor, a sense of duty, a sense of legality, a sense that lethality should be deployed only under the most extreme circumstances. And the U.S. military has done an outstanding job of that since the end of the Vietnam War. They've done it while certainly under pressure from Congress and the public, but the U.S. military had done a remarkable job to police itself right up through the Afghan War. And all of that is out the window now. And AI being introduced at this level at this moment only makes it more dangerous.
I'm going to raise this experiment at New College London, which tested out three leading AI systems from OpenAI, Anthropic, and Google in war simulations. They found that the AI didn't have nearly the same reservations as humans and used nuclear weapons in 95% of cases. Dean Ball, who helped develop President Trump's AI policy in a senior post at the White House last year, posted on X, quote, if near medium future AI systems can be used by the executive branch to arbitrary ends with zero restrictions, the U.S. will functionally cease to be a republic. I mean, where do you think all this is going?
To Dr. Strangelove. I think we're in a moment where, if you remember Dr. Strangelove, and I know you do, the whole film ends with a moment at which the momentum of decision-making for nuclear war was unstoppable. This imposition and installation of AI decision-making systems that minimize human influence over what kind of weapons we're going to use, when we will use them, sort of like satisfying the dream of the extremists among the nuclear strategists of the 1950s and 60s. So, you know, look, we've also had, to great credit of the United States, an actual debate for 70 years over when and how to use the most lethal weapons. We actually had debate at the highest levels. The fact that we trusted a president, not just a president, like eight presidents, with the lives of the entire world, understanding that most human beings would make the right decision when offered the right information. That level of trust that we put into presidents of both parties, many of whom were not really great people, says a lot about the fact that we've managed to live this long and we had a system that mostly worked. Are we in that situation? Do we have an executive we can trust with the future of the world who actually thinks about the children in a girls' school in a remote corner of Iran? Do we have a president who thinks about the long-term repercussions of the use of certain weapons and the deployment of certain technologies? You know, I think it's safe to say we do not. So all of that difficult work that has been done in the military, in the RAND Corporation, in the halls of Congress, in White House after White House after White House for decades has been stripped out. We are in a very dangerous moment in which to rely on these systems.
Siva, thank you so much.
I wish I could say talking about this was a pleasure, Brooke, but it is always a pleasure to speak to you and be part of this really important program.
Siva Vaidyanathan is a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia. Wonder why some would-be dictators succeed and others fail? Coming up, a history lesson with news you can actually use. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Odoo. Odoo streamlines every aspect of a company into one simple business management platform. More information at odoo.com.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, as the war widened and the death toll rose in the Middle East, House and Senate Democrats proposed resolutions to curb our president's ability to wage more war without legislative approval. Those resolutions failed, adding to the heap of headlines marking what many scholars have called America's democratic backsliding. But those same headlines spurred Vox senior correspondent Zach Beauchamp to delve into previous power grabs by would-be despots to see who won or lost or how some nations managed to climb back up that slide. Then he put all he learned in a book, The Reactionary Spirit. Zach, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here, Brooke.
So you decided to study democratic resilience because you were getting sick of all those articles about Trump being bad for democracy. Although, weirdly, your conclusion is that we need those articles about Trump being bad for democracy.
I know. It was really funny. This project was born out of a crisis of confidence in the journalism profession in Trump's second term. We had spent 10 years, roughly, doing our best to try to illustrate that this man was an exceptional danger to American democracy. And I don't mean that in the sense that reporters were out to get him. And I started to wonder, what's the point of all those warnings if we're in the middle of a crisis? And so I went to go study, not, okay, things are bad. What do we do to make them better?
And you used recent history as a guide, starting with research done by Laura Gamboa, political scientist at the University of Notre Dame, who compared two democracies directly. Colombia resisted, Venezuela didn't. Tell me what you learned.
Basically, the situation in Venezuela and Colombia under Presidents Hugo Chavez and Alvaro Uribe was that you had an elected executive who was doing the sorts of things that are very familiar, trying to concentrate power in their own hands, limit checks on their own authority. What diverged is the opposition strategies. In Venezuela, the opposition pushed really hard to go outside of the system and try to topple the president just like in one fell swoop. We're talking things like a military coup. And that ended up backfiring. It gave the Chavez government the justification that it needed to say the opposition is not trying to play within the rules of the democratic game. They're enemies of the state. We need to stand up for ourselves and we need to go after these traitors. And so the end result was that Chavez developed a level of domestic political legitimacy to crack down on democracy that he didn't have otherwise. The Colombian opposition adopted a very different strategy. What they wanted to do was slow down Uribe's agenda in the legislature to prevent him from passing laws that could concentrate power in his own hands until the next elections, which they gambled they could win. And they did. And so Colombia's, what might have been a democratic emergency, ended up being a case of maybe a near miss.
You found that people actually like democracy if they can be shaken out of their complacency to see that it is actually under threat. The example that you like to give is Peru.
We're talking 2022 under President Pedro Castillo.
Pedro Castillo has announced a dissolution of Congress and called for legislative elections to draft a new constitution. That comes hours before an impeachment debate. Now, members of the Constitutional Court describe the move as a coup. The situation.
There's an immediate outcry, and he sort of backs down really, really quickly. He was impeached on the very same day, which is absolutely wild to think of in the American context. That illustrates that when you're too flagrant, you can incite opposition.
And you argue that aspiring dictators, for this very reason, are particularly wary of damaging their self-image.
You know, I've spent a lot of time studying Hungary and Israel, which are two of the most notable examples of democratic backsliding right now. And one thing that those leaders share is a deep commitment to using plausible-sounding democratic justifications for the power grabs. For example, when Viktor Orban works to limit the rights of civil society groups that might criticize him, he says, well, it's because they're supporting the invasion of our country by foreign hordes, or they're acting on behalf of Brussels and these people who will control us and destroy our sovereignty. And in Israel, it's the Supreme Court when they're trying to limit Netanyahu's power and sort of preserve the foundations of the system. The court is unelected bureaucrats, really dictators who are running Israel from behind the scenes, and we need to restore power to our voters.
That is familiar rhetoric.
You can hear Stephen Miller say the same thing on an almost daily basis when they get an adverse ruling from a lower court. Classic populist argument used to maintain this democratic facade.
And you say that political scientists and democratic activists typically focus on structural factors like economic development or the institutional design, the president versus the parliamentary system, to explain why authoritarians succeed or fail. But you think it's the legibility of the threat to democracy that matters most?
Very much so. What happened in Minneapolis is a determined level of civilian resistance to what they saw to be an authoritarian policy by the government that was abusing their neighbors, disrupting their communities, and ultimately claimed the lives of two American citizens, that motivated significant resistance.
Overreach by the would-be autocrat?
That's right. One common pattern I found in countries where an authoritarian's bid to consolidate power in a democracy fails is that they end up doing something that's just so obviously authoritarian that it sets off massive levels of resistance that can't be overcome. This didn't obviously bring down the Trump presidency, but it's really important for listeners to understand this isn't like a movie where there's one big fight. It's a war of attrition. So each little struggle matters.
Talk about another example of democratic resilience in Brazil and Trump's great good friend who he tried to get pardoned.
Right, so that's Jair Bolsonaro, who was elected to the presidency of Brazil in 2018. I went to Brazil as part of this reporting project because I thought it was a country that had the most similarities with the U.S. in a lot of important ways. Bolsonaro was frequently called the Trump of the tropics when he was running for office, and he lived up to that reputation. He'd been an open fan of Brazil's military dictatorship that ended back in 1985. When Bolsonaro won, for reasons mostly related to corruption in the rest of the political system, there was a real awareness that this guy might be dangerous. And the place that you saw that most clearly was in Brazil's Supreme Court. Some of what they did, I want to be clear, was not
great. At the same time, the justices were instrumental in stopping some of Bolsonaro's most authoritarian moves. I'll give you one striking example. When he was up for re-election, that he was widely expected to lose, he sent the National Highway Police to block the buses taking voters to the polls in Brazil's northeast, the opposition stronghold. And within hours, the Supreme Court said no. People got to the polls, they voted, and Bolsonaro's opponent, the current president, Luiz Inácio da Silva, called Lula, won, but by a very narrow margin.
So if Bolsonaro was the Trump of the tropics, the South Korean president, Yoon Suk-yeol, was the Bolsonaro of East Asia?
That's right. That's what I wrote in the piece, a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but it's accurate. Yoon, like Bolsonaro, was an open fan of the military dictatorship that also in Korea had gone into the 1980s. But when Yoon was elected, again, due to some problems people had with the left-wing opposition party, he was not very popular and was someone who was very concerned about communist infiltration. The Korean left is always concerned about the right wanting to bring back the dictatorship, and the right is always concerned about the left trying to open the door to North Korean influence on politics. So it can make the stakes really high. And Yoon was, even by the standards of this high-stakes politics, extreme and paranoid. And then after he loses the 2024 midterm elections, he decides to declare a state of emergency one night in early December. It's very dramatic. There's a proclamation of martial law that bans the media from publishing, that declares opposition political activity temporarily unlawful. This immediately prompts pushback. The most famous example of this is the legislators who jumped the fence in the legislative building in order to go in and vote to end the state of emergency. The head of the opposition live-streamed himself doing it. But one thing that I think gets a little bit less attention is the way in which ordinary Koreans reacted. Thousands of Koreans showed up on the streets of Seoul. Yoon had, as part of the martial law order, ordered the arrest of leading opposition figures. The protesters put themselves between the security services and access to the broader city, to opposition lawmakers, and so on.
They just walked directly in front of trucks
and
stood there.
Right. And that may have prevented Yoon from successfully executing on his blueprint for seizing control.
Your last example that we'll be examining here is Poland versus Hungary. What Trump has been doing has been likened again and again to what Orban did in Hungary. The thing that was obviously most noticeable to us were the regular attacks on the press.
Yes. What he did was coerce various different Hungarian media outlets into selling to conglomerates that were owned by allies of the government. Then the tycoons who owed their position specifically to the prime minister would fire the journalists not willing to toe the government line and would remake the entire institution.
That is how Hungary succeeded in defeating democracy. How did Poland wrest it back?
So the Polish government that was in power until recently tried to follow a similar playbook. They hollowed out the state broadcaster. It was much more subtle than what you saw in South Korea or Brazil, and much more like this Hungarian model. You know, it worked for them for a long time. They even won re-election in 2019, right after first being elected in 2015. But they really created a deep sense of threat among one really important group, which is the political opposition. Prior to 2015, you know, Poland had a multi-party system. These opposition parties spanned the ideological gamut. They were not inclined to cooperate. But once the threat became clear, in 2019, they came to an agreement not to run against each other in Poland's election.
Just mind-boggling.
The alliance that they made really spanned ideological divides. Like, it would be as if the Mitt Romney faction of the Republican Party, back when it existed in meaningful numbers, broke with Trump and started campaigning with the Democrats. We're talking large numbers of representatives and senators. And they said it was because of democracy explicitly. They knew what the stakes were. And they took back the Senate, which is less important than the lower house in Poland, but still it allowed them to obstruct legislation. And then in 2023, they worked really hard to campaign against the current government as kind of a change block. But the opposition was pushed to do that by the government, targeting the judiciary and trying to take it over, but also leading an incitement campaign against Donald Tusk, who was the most visible opposition figure. They tried to paint him as a foreign interloper due to his work with the European Union. Didn't work very well. All it did do was convince the opposition that the current government really had it out to get them, right? They pushed a law that would have disqualified him from running from office. And if they can do that to one person, well, they could do that to anybody, right?
But isn't that stuff kind of happening here? I mean, Trump is saying, will no one rid me of this meddlesome priest over and over and over again about all his enemies. What can the average person who feels alarmed for the state of their democracy take from this history that you created?
The big lesson here is that people actually do care about democracy. It's not the sort of canard that has come up since the 2024 election, that democracy isn't a motivating factor.
Just talk about the economy, they say.
And look, that might be true if you're, let's say, a Senate candidate in Ohio or Texas or something like that, that your message should be different. Because democracy's motivating power depends on what I've called the legibility of democratic threat. If you can point out that democracy is under threat, if you can make that case to them in a way that resonates with their experience, you can galvanize and motivate politically significant actions.
How do you make that case?
You talk about it. That's why we're right back where I started at the beginning, right? When I said I was frustrated with saying democracy is under threat all the time. Now I'm convinced you need to say democracy is under threat all the time. Don't be annoying in your friends. Don't be like, what should we do this weekend? Should we go to a bar? No, democracy is under threat. Like, don't be that guy. Operate within bounds. But you have to talk about this stuff. Treat people as if they are your fellow citizens.
As if they have power. And you believe they do.
They do. And it's not just that we pull the lever at the voting box once every 2 or 4 years. It's that we have the ability to speak, to convince our fellow citizens that something is happening.
Jefferson talked about eternal vigilance. What evidence do we have that countries can resist these attacks on democracy for more than just one election cycle?
It's honestly too soon to say, right? Part of the reason that we don't know a lot about how democracies save themselves is because the very notion of democratic backsliding is relatively modern, right? It used to be the case that democracies were understood as quote-unquote consolidated, which is the political science term for you've had a democracy for so long and it seems so stable that surely it'll just stay that way, right? Now it turns out even old, very well-established democracies can come under existential threat. That's a very modern phenomenon, though. It's mostly a 21st century thing.
Poland's far right is making headway again. And you noted that Bolsonaro's son is running in Brazil?
That's right. One poll I saw recently had him dead even with Lula. It's not impossible to imagine that one of the norms in countries like the United States where democracy has come under threat is ping-ponging between authoritarianism and democracy, which is frightening to think about, but it could very well be the future. The truth is we don't know.
Good times, Zach.
Good times. Good times indeed.
Zach, thank you very much.
I always love doing the show. It's a pleasure.
Zach Beauchamp is senior correspondent at Vox and author of The Reactionary Spirit. And that's the show. On the Media is produced by Molly Rosen, Rebecca Clark Callender, and Candace Wong. Travis Mannon is our video producer. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson, with engineering from Jared Paul. Eloise Blondio is our senior producer, and our executive producer is Katya Rogers. On the Media is produced by WNYC. Michael Oehinger will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
That's just before 7 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Up ahead, Weekend Edition from National Public Radio. We'll also hear the Up North Report, local news from our region. 9 o'clock this morning, we have a special for you. Malachi Coons has an hour of conversation and music with Indigenous archivist Justice Broken Rope about Wateca Records. And 10 o'clock, Corey Campbell, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Weather for today, mostly cloudy through mid-morning, then clearing with highs 38 to 44, winds from the northwest 10 to 20. Our lows tonight 32 to 36, and tomorrow mostly sunny with highs in the 50s. Looking ahead to Monday, mostly sunny, bit cooler with highs 39 to 46.